this itch, rather, if you want to say, to just tell, just to speak. And there are many reasons why this is, you know, just to, you know, be the, you know, the cool one, if you like to call, the one who's always in the know, the one who's always doing silly things, and many other reasons that one can think about why a person will want to tell secrets of other people, and even their own secrets to other people. And unfortunately, we live in a world where modesty has come to such a lower extent that, you know, when someone tells you a particular secret, it is actually a form of honor and pride for that person. Na'udhu billah. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to protect our secrets and the secrets of others if we are told them, or if we even see them, inshallah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The Spotlight. Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has vowed to double, if not quadruple, the population of the occupied Golan Heights, and that, as he claims, in response to Iran planning to build an army on the border in that area. Tel Aviv regime occupied the Syrian Heights in the course of a war in 1967. No country has recognized Israeli sovereignty to the Golan except the United States. Now let's go to Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus, and let's hear the Syrian side of the story and how they react to this. Mohammed, over to you.
Yes, the Syrian people always reject the Israeli occupation in the occupied Syrian Golan. All of the villages there, the residents, they continuously express that clearly in rallies and protests. The recent was in Mas'ad, the village just a couple of days ago, in the occupied Syrian Golan, in which residents there rallied, rejecting the implementation of any Israeli settlement plan on their territories, on their lands. And they said that they will block the Israeli occupation authorities from taking control over their land. On the other hand, the Syrian Foreign Ministry issued yesterday an official statement condemning strongly the statements of the Israeli Prime Minister on increasing the number of Israeli settlers in the occupied Syrian Golan. An official source at the Foreign Ministry actually here in Damascus said that such statements confirm once again the expansionist and aggressive nature of the Zionist entity, and also it shows its clear violation of international resolutions, namely the United Nations Security Council resolutions, on the legal status quo of the Golan, which is an occupied territory. Also, the Foreign Ministry said that such statements and aggressive policies will not change the truth and the fact that this that the Syrian Golan was and will remain a Syrian land and will be restored by Syria no matter how much time it takes. Finally, it's very important to say that the Syrian government officials always say in their statements with regards to the occupied Golan that Syria reserves the right to carry out any means possible in order to restore back the occupied Syrian Golan. We know that Syria tried diplomacy and negotiations, but the Israeli side always rejected to give it back.
Right. Okay, thank you very much for that. Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus, Syria. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and today we'll be discussing Israeli land grab. Let me introduce our guests in this edition. From the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, we'll be joined by Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. Also, from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, we'll have Ken Stone out of Hamilton, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, now let me start. Hello and welcome to our guests. Now, let me put this question to Mick. Mick, as you know, Israel occupied the Golan Heights, but the move has not been recognized by the international community. It's only the U.S. recognized. So one basic question, what's the strategic significance of the Golan Heights for the Tel Aviv regime?
For the Tel Aviv regime, it's the same as the whole Palestine. It's resources. And the colonization of the Golan by the Tel Aviv regime is aimed at several things. One, a third of Israel's water, current area that Israel controls, one third of the total amount of water comes from the Golan. And Netanyahu and his fellows, that's why they insisted Israel was going to hold on to the Golan forever. Now, not a single country apart from Trump's USA and Biden going along with it recognizes this annexation. But it's strategic, it's for resources, it's a place where Israel tries to build, you know, more illegal settlements. So it's strategy, population dissemination across that area. And it's very, very similar to Palestine. When the land was occupied in 67, Israel drove out, very similar to Palestine, about 90% of the Arab population. About 130,000 people were kicked out, expelled immediately. Mm. And Israel thought that it could integrate and do a deal with the remaining Arabs, who were mainly Druze, and that has proven not to be the case. That Druze population are adamant that they're Syrian. They have resisted. What's different from Palestine is Israel's constantly trying to deny Palestinians any citizenship, certainly including Israel. Mm-hmm. But in the Golan Heights, they have been trying to force Israeli citizenship on the Arab population. And that has been fiercely resisted since 1967 until the present day. Israel's attempts, using all sorts of bureaucratic measures, physical pressure as well, that has been resisted by the Syrian Arab Druze population.
Okay. Now, Ken, Naftali Bennett says that in 6 weeks' time, Tel Aviv will approve a plan for the Golan Heights that will include the creation of settlement. So what gives this regime the audacity to make such an open announcement in broad daylight?
They can make such an audacious proposal because they have the backing of many of the, first of all, the U.S. Empire, and most of its allies in the West, in NATO and other countries. The proposal itself is flagrantly illegal because it flies in the face of the 1949 Geneva Agreement on the Treatment of Peoples Under Occupation, to which my country, Canada, was a high consenting party. And rather than enforcing the rules of the Geneva Convention of 1949, which say that the occupier may not change the demographic balance of the populations under occupation, Canada instead is one of the countries that enables this colonization enables the creation of these settlements by allowing organizations in Canada, such as the Jewish National Fund of Canada, which raises money with its charitable status granted by the Canadian government to give tax-free tax-free donations from Canadians to the State of Israel to build these Jewish-only settlements. So what the practical result is that by giving these tax-free donations to the State of Israel, all Canadians are forced to subsidize these donations, which are being used illegally to colonize the Golan Heights, just as they are in the West Bank, and they are used to try and alter the demographic balance of that region, which is flagrantly illegal.
Now, Mick, regarding the Golan Heights, Bennett is saying they're doing this because of Iran, and they'll do whatever necessary to end Iran's presence in Syria. Bennett says Iran has no business there. Now, it's Israel that has been launching, you know, hundreds of airstrikes against Syrian positions since 2011, not Iran. So who's making an adventure, Iran or Israel?
Well, look at the long-term record. Look at the words of Israeli leaders, among whom the most iconic is Ben-Gurion. Mm. And he was absolutely clear that the Zionist project in Palestine, even if it remains in Palestine, need weakened and devastated Arab neighbors. I mean, today there are maybe 6 million Zionist Jews, a million or so non-Zionist Jews in Palestine, controlling that area, surrounded by hundreds of millions of Arabs. Now, that situation cannot endure for very long, even with Israel's military edge, unless its neighbors are destroyed or its neighbors are greatly weakened. And we see what's happened in Syria as an example. So it's part of Israeli policy to ensure its own so-called security by denying basic conditions of life to the citizens of neighboring countries. And, you know, we're in an era of a second wave of colonialism. The rules that our fellow guest alludes to, which were passed after World War II, by and large, international law, the prohibition of the seizure and obtaining land by conquest, that was never intended for colonial peoples. And we now see a kind of Sykes-Picot Mark II, where when Britain and France divided up the Middle East and they drew the lines dividing neighbors from neighbors and setting up countries after the First World War, we now see Donald Trump giving the Golan to the Israeli government. More recently, we saw the Americans giving the Western Sahara to Morocco in return for recognition of Zionist claims in Palestine. So, right. Once again, the fate of local people is being decided in Washington and elsewhere. So, yeah, the Zionist project needs virtually permanent war, and that has been the record since 1948.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ken, the Israeli Prime Minister says, as I just said, Iran has nothing to do in Syria, and this is while Iran is in Syria under request of the Syrian government. What's Bennett talking about?
The Israeli Prime Minister is trying to whip up hatred and fear of Iran in his own country, so it's partly for domestic use, and it's a narrative that plays in well with the U.S. Media and government narrative as well. Iran is an independent country with its own agenda for politics and economics, and it's not been compliant with the wishes of the United States for the last 40 years since the Islamic Revolution. And the U.S. and Israel have both gone out of their way to try and bring down. They've been trying for regime change in Iran for 40 years, and any of the countries that are allied to it, such as Syria. But Iran has every right to be in Syria because they are invited into Syria by the Syrian government to resist the attempt by the United States and its allies, including Israel, to overthrow the Syrian government. And to add, as my colleague Mick Napier has alluded to, it's a plan to destabilize and break up the Arab countries of the region, the better to be able to control them, just as they did with Libya and Iraq, and they tried in Yemen as well. They're trying in Yemen as mm-hmm. well. But the fact is that this demonstration that we're talking about today is a great sign of the demonstration of the people in the Golan Heights resisting the Israeli settlements, because it's showing the increasing strength of the resistance across the region to Israeli occupation and to the U.S. empire meddling in the affairs of the Middle mm-hmm. East. So I say kudos to the demonstrators, and I say kudos to Press TV for giving voice to them. Press TV gives the voice to the voiceless, and this is a good example of the amplification of the grassroots demand in the countries of the Middle East that Israel get out, stop its occupation, and the U.S. empire withdraw from the region. Mm.
Okay, speaking of the U.S., Mick, there is only one country on the planet recognizing Israel's capture of Syria's Golan Heights. That's the United States. And former President Trump recognized Israel's sovereignty over this strategic plateau in 2019. There was also a new town called Trump Heights that was inaugurated on the Golan to honor his move. Your take on that?
Yes, I mean, it's very revealing. The only place in the world where Trump was viewed very positively was the state of Israel, and very prominent among that were the few settlers in the Golan. Look, Israel enjoys the staunch support, not just of the USA, but a little bit more subtly, not very subtly, by the EU and, of course, by the British government as well. And the reason is very simple. The resistance we see in the Golan by the Syrian Arab Druze, indigenous people of the Golan, is a sign that the Zionist project runs into problems. America does not trust the Saudi regime or the Emiratis or even the Egyptians or the Moroccans, these monarchies, to survive well into the 21st century. They do trust Israel. Israel being a settler colonial project, it's not a case of the government allying with America against the wishes of the population, which is the case in Arab countries. It's a case of the mass of the Jewish population there, the Zionist population, which is privileged by that link and given domination over the Palestinians. They actually support the link with Washington. Washington knows that. Everybody knows that. Therefore, they allow Israel to do pretty much what it wants. There are some exceptions when they pull on the chain, but generally speaking, that's why Israel's allowed to seize a part of the Golan. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely criminal, and it's also criminal that the native people of the Golan are now, like the Palestinians, in fact, the numbers are almost the same. The Golan Arabs are restricted to about 7% of the area, which they used to be the majority of people in, just as Palestinians are now reduced to living in about 6% of 1948 Israel. So it's colonization, it's dispossession, it's trying to put surplus populations or difficult populations, non-Jewish populations, into mm-hmm. increasingly small ghettos. America doesn't hate the people of the Golan. It doesn't even hate the Palestinians. It gives Israel its green light because Israel is a huge strategic asset. As Hassan Nasrallah said, when you're fighting Israel, you're actually fighting America, because America ultimately, despite what many people think, America ultimately calls the tune for Israel. Israel's got some autonomy, but when it goes too far, America puts it in its place. But it means Israel's allowed to do pretty much what it wants as long as it remains loyal to Uncle Sam.
Okay. Speaking of Uncle Sam, the rumors that in June the Biden administration was planning to reverse the recognition, which infuriated the Israelis, Then we had a U.S. State Department spokesperson coming out and saying that a U.S. policy regarding the Golan has not changed. And Washington continues to recognize the Northern Plateau as Israeli territory. So the question is, what is it that makes the U.S. stick to its unwavering support for Israel, no matter who's at the helm of the White House?
Well, I think my colleague Nick Napier alluded to that just now when he said that Israel is a beachhead, is a power projection point for the U.S. empire in the Middle East. And because of that, the U.S. gives it a blank check. It gives it money. It gives it arms. It gives it political support and diplomatic support, because it's like a military base for the U.S. in the Middle East. And no matter who is in charge in Israel, the policy towards the Palestinians and the policy of the aggrandizement of the Zionist colonial project is always the same. And whoever is in the White House, the policy doesn't change either. The policy remains the same, and that is that the U.S. is seeking hegemony in the Middle East. It's seeking hegemony, domination over the entire world. And Israel is part of, is one of the pillars of that hegemony in the Middle East. It has other countries it relies on, such as the Arab monarchies, but Israel is the most secure and dependable ally of the U.S., and so it gets favored child status from the U.S., and all of the NATO allies and all of the EU fall in right behind. The EU gives Israel a special status, almost the status of a member state of the EU, such that Israel gets to have all the benefits of the economic relationship with the EU. So there, it's a neo-colonial project. Israel represents the boots on the ground for the European and North American colonial project in the Middle East.
Okay. Mick, what's the solution? I mean, what could Syria do, you know, to retake the occupied Golan Heights and restore its sovereignty there?
At the moment, little, because Israel has a huge military edge, which it is using to attack and bomb many parts of Syria. But in the long term, it will depend upon whether more countries join the USA or not in allocating the Golan, giving the Golan and its people to Israel. I think there's a protracted period where everything will rely upon the resistance of the native people of the Golan. What a record they have. You know, despite Israeli pressure, despite overwhelming Israeli power, they've once again demonstrated their determination not to become Israelis. This builds on mass identity card burning. Now, if you think about Israel, but an the threat to remove an identity card has got life-changing consequences. In the Golan, we saw I forget the year, the early 80s, mass burning of identity cards by the Golan people. We saw very large strikes against attempts to impose Israeli nationality, Israeli citizenship. And that endures, and the current mobilization shows that the fires have not been extinguished despite Israel's overwhelming power. This is so inspiring. And when resistance is strong enough, sometimes even America gets a little bit afraid. I think it's very instructive what happened last week. An Israeli court delivered over the Al-Aqsa Mosque to extremist fanatical Jews to use for their religious purposes. That was reversed.
Right.
And I think it was reversed because the Americans intervened to tell the Israelis that is just a step too far at the moment. That could be dangerous. They were afraid of the mass rebellion and resistance to that move. So I think the resistance in the Golan holds out the promise that the Zionist project in that area that it controls can be defeated.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of the show. Let me thank our guests from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. We had McNapier in Edinburgh and Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, Ken Stone out of Hamilton, Ontario. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you later.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhis salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام وقد سأله رجل فأجابه فقال الرجل إن الفقهاء لا يقولون هذا قال يا ويحك وهل رأيت فقيها قط إن الفقيه حق الفقيه الزاهد في الدنيا الراغب في الآخرة المتمسك بسنة النبي صلى الله عليه وآله.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was once asked the question by a man, to which he duly replied, and to which the man then retorted, "The jurists do not say this." The Imam said, "Woe unto you! Have you ever seen a jurist? A real jurist is a person who is ascetic from this world, who craves for the hereafter, and strongly holds unto the tradition of the Prophet."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the various conversations and beautiful dialogues that Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, had, we find that he talked quite a bit about akhlaq. And akhlaq, of course, is morals and ethics. In these conversations, he put forth these beautiful pieces of wisdom and advice and knowledge when speaking with his companions and his friends and his relatives and the people in general. In one such conversation, he was asked by his companions to define humbleness for them. And so Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said in reply in this conversation that humbleness is that you should be satisfied with the humble sitting place. Humbleness is that you should greet whoever you meet. And humbleness is that you should leave the dispute, even if you are right.
So going a little bit deeper into these statements about humbleness from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam in this conversation, we find that the first thing that Imam al-Baqir said was that we should be satisfied with the humble sitting place, meaning that our homes, the place where we sit, is referring to our homes. Our homes should be humble. They shouldn't be extravagant. They shouldn't be extra luxurious. Now, we're not saying that it should be uncomfortable. No, it should be comfortable. It should be a happy setting. It should be a satisfying setting, you know. But it shouldn't be luxurious. It shouldn't be extravagant. It shouldn't have, you know, things which we would call israf, extravagance, you know, plates of gold and silver or pipes of gold and silver and the like. The next thing that Imam al-Baqir said about humbleness was to greet whoever you meet. Now here, of course, this means to not be arrogant. If a poor person comes and greets you, you should greet them. If somebody who is older than you comes, you should greet them. If somebody is younger, you should greet them. So in general, don't be arrogant when you meet other people. Greet them. And finally, Imam al-Baqir says that humbleness is that you should leave the dispute even if you are right. Now here, when he means dispute, it means that when you realize the other person is not going to listen to you, you realize that the other person is not going to take what you're saying into consideration, the other person is not willing to listen to the truth, then at that point, even if you are right, don't continue to dispute, because it just turns into an unnecessary argument. Beautiful words of advice. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
His birth is just before the events of Karbala in the year 57. And he lived for 57 years. Out of which about last 19 years were the time of his imamate. One of the important things about him is that before I go to the an example of his status as the alim of Ali Muhammad is concerned, is his family line. He is unique among the imams. From his father's side, he is Muhammad bin Ali, bin Hussein, bin Ali wa Fatima. From his mother's side, he is Ibn Abdullah, bint Hassan, bin Ali wa Fatima. It's from both sides of the father and the mother, it goes back to Ali and Fatima. And therefore he was known as Alaviyun Bayn al-Alaviyin. Means he's an Alavi total from both sides of his father as well as his mother's. So his father, Ali Zain al-Abidin, is son of Imam Hussein. His mother, Umm Abdullah, is the daughter of Imam Hassan. So what is the relationship there? They are first cousins. That's not the topic tonight, don't worry. But just want to make a point here that, you know, marriage between first cousins is not an issue, you know, discouraged or abhorred or makruh in the Islamic Sharia. No, it is there. It is the seerat of the A'imma also. Of course, we do not believe that the marriage should only be within the family, only between the cousins. Or, you know, cousins have a right on one another. No, there is nothing like that. But there is nothing which says that cousin marriage is discouraged. unless it becomes a secondary issue. If things have been going on, you know, from one generation to another, to third, to fourth, to fifth, and then the physical deficiencies and some of the hereditary traits multiply negatively, then it becomes a secondary issue. Then because of the secondary reasons, you should refrain from marrying within the same family. Otherwise, by itself, there is no abhorrence or karahat at all in the Islamic Sharia as far as marriage between the first cousins is concerned.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After taking power, the Taliban leaders reached to the Shia community seeking their support and allegiance. The Taliban officials said their government will include all Afghans and social justice will be protected.
Today's Shia people are safer than before. We don't let any individual hurt you. You are from Afghanistan and have equal rights. The Islamic Emirate recognizes you as part of Afghan society.
The Shia Ulama Council at a press conference on August 24 urged the Taliban to ensure that they will treat all faiths and ethnicities with equality and justice.
We are happy that U.S. forces have left our country. Congratulations to the Afghan nation. In the meantime, we demand and recommend that the Taliban fulfill their promises by forming an all-inclusive government.
During weeks under the Taliban rule, many people from the Shia community have reportedly been displaced in Dikandi and some were massacred by the Taliban in Ghazni and Dikandi, Amnesty International confirms. At the same time, the Daesh still takes lives from the community. Nearly 300 Shia worshippers were killed and wounded in Kunduz blast on Friday. Following this tragic event, Shia Clerics Council in Afghanistan once again urged the Taliban to investigate the deadly attack and take massacre of Shia seriously, as well as call for unity among all Muslims.
Shias are making 20% of the population of Afghanistan. The Taliban can't establish an inclusive Islamic government without giving equal role to us. We also condemn the catastrophic attack in Kunduz and urge the Taliban to bring its perpetrators to justice.
After taking power, the Taliban promised the formation of an inclusive government and providing a safe ground for all Afghans. But Shia minority is concerned that the threat of Daesh terrorist group is being ignored by the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš is the most high-profile politician in the EU to be exposed by the Pandora Papers leak earlier this month. It was revealed that Babiš, who lost a re-election bid just last Saturday, spent €19 million using tax haven companies to buy a chateau in France. The scandal has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Andrej Babiš behaves again as a hypocrite, as a liar, as a person despising democracy, but this time also as a businessman doing shady transactions.
Hundreds of current and former politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, and drug dealers have used so-called shell companies to hide their wealth and investments.
Madam President, I am livid.
A consortium of journalists from around the world compiled a report containing 12 million leaked documents, dubbed the Pandora Papers.
As countries scramble for millions to fund health and social services, $11 trillion are out of reach offshore.
Most of those avoiding tax are based in the West. EU leaders who talk a lot about values are accused of hypocrisy.
Why is the United States, which is not cooperative, again not mentioned, whereas in the Pandora Papers it's very clear that the United States are becoming a bigger and bigger problem?
Experts warn the issue will never be resolved unless the rich and powerful develop a conscience.
I think that the ultimate question in the end is individual ethics, and living by good example, you know, by those, you know, who actually want to defend the system. And without that, the best monitoring, the best legal framework, the best regulation can't save you.
Legislators say a big problem relates to the amount of money politicians and policymakers can generate for themselves.
Where action could but isn't taken, there's obviously no political will to stop mass tax evasion by the super rich.
Revelations like these are nothing new. Lawmakers say it proves European Commission policies in this area are not working, and therefore it is simply a matter of time before more scandals come to light. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Karim Abu Salim crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Karim Abu Salim threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector. That is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Karim Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Karim Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lost our money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also express the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that caused serious financial losses. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, elderly people,
We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Actually, this is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world. And I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are don't seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we're going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, keep it in the ground. Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue. That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially. World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, now the Taliban are rolling over Kabul and other cities and provinces across the nation. New messages painted on the walls in the city center are a reminder of visible changes. Our nation has, with the help of God, defeated America. One of the new Taliban slogans reads, replacing the previous colorful painting. The Afghan flag has largely been replaced with the white Islamic Emirate emblem, with many selling the new banners amid heavy traffic across the city.
After the Taliban takeover, I started selling the Taliban's flags and slogans. It is a good business for me. Many Taliban soldiers and their followers buy and display them on the cars, motorbikes and houses. I make good money and it is getting better day by day.
Another challenging change, the level of poverty is rising. Women are selling their gold to get some cash to support their families. Many have lost their jobs, with some struggling to make food for their family. Others are selling household items to make ends meet.
I've brought my household items for sale because there are no jobs. What should we do for a living? I asked the Taliban to create jobs. They must prepare the ground for us to work. Today we are selling household items. What should we do tomorrow?
The most obvious change is the presence of Taliban members themselves. The Taliban are seen roaming the city, guns flung over their shoulders. Some are wearing uniforms and some are in local clothes. And another change, many women are seen to be staying off the streets, but some are seen in longer coats and headscarves, and some in the all-covering burqa. Fewer men are seen wearing Western dress as they have switched to local clothes. The Taliban takeover changed the face of capital Kabul in many ways. The nation's already flagging economy is collapsing and creeping chaos is in the making. It remains to be seen what future holds for the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
London is now hosting the biggest and most expensive Islamic exhibit, which focuses its entire attention to the life and legacy of the cousin and son-in-law of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad. The Imam Ali exhibit takes viewers on an interactive journey through the life of Ali ibn Abi Talib, whose loyal service helped create a lasting and perfect religion. Imam Ali is beloved by all Muslims across the globe. For Sunnis, he's revered as the fourth rightly guided Khalifa, but for Shias, he's the first holy Imam. This exhibit offers an exciting and unique opportunity for the community to reconnect with one of Islam's most important historical figures, but also for viewers to learn more information about the life of this character, including things which may have been forgotten historically. Run by the Legacy Group, the creators told Press TV they hoped retracing the life of Imam Ali in full will leave visitors with a renewed connection to this Islamic legend.
So we believe that that Ali ibn Abi Talib is one of the most amazing characters in history. He appeals to a wide audience. He famously said that he's a person that either your brother in faith or your equal in humanity. His letter to Malik al-Ashtar, which is his governor in Cairo, was referenced by the United Nations as being a reference point for the Arab leaders of the world because he was so adamant on justice, on social equality, on fair governance, on non-corruption. And his life as a leader in 4.5 years epitomized and personified that. So our appeal is to share this information with a global audience to come and visit and to see this place.
The exhibit is clearly a roaring success, with hundreds visiting each opening day. Organizers say that expansion plans are in motion, and they intend to remain open for the foreseeable future, meaning that Imam Ali's legacy continues to inspire even outside of traditional Muslim homelands. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis have held an event in front of the As-Salah Al-Kubra Community Hall in Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the fifth anniversary of a massacre committed by the Saudi-led coalition in 2016. Participants condemned the international silence toward this brutal crime, saying when it comes to Yemen, the West continues to show its double standards. Abdusalam Amir is one of those who were present during the attack, where he got injured.
On that day, the sheikhs of the Nahim tribe and I attended to offer condolences to the Al-Ruwaishan family because of our relationship with them. I was sitting there when the unexpected happened, a terrorist crime that killed and injured more than 700 of the best men of Yemen. This criminal act does not differ from the terrorist operations carried out by the coalition of aggression in all cities of Yemen over the past years, and the source of all these crimes is the extremist Wahhabi ideology led by the House of Saud.
On October 8, 2016, Saudi warplanes targeted the As-Salah Al-Kubra Community Hall in Sana'a with at least two air-dropped munitions during a funeral ceremony. Over 140 people were killed and more than 600 others were injured in the attack, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
People here say the bombing of the funeral ceremony at the As-Salah Al-Kubra Community Hall revealed the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition against Yemenis. They say Riyadh's crimes will never be forgotten and Saudi Arabia should be brought to justice for its crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus and met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They discussed the military condition in Syrian soil. President Assad stressed that work will continue until liberating all Syrian territories from terrorism and ending foreign illegal presence. Talks also covered regional and international developments, including the situation in Afghanistan. Amir Abdullahian briefed President Assad on the Iranian nuclear file negotiations, expressing Iran's goal to achieve sustainable development. He said Iran wants to cooperate with its neighbors to break the economic siege on his country and neutralize sanctions imposed on the Iranians. Amir Abdullahian also underlined the importance of boosting economic cooperation with Syria.
In the past weeks, we reached important agreements for a full development of relations between both countries in all fields, as well as setting programs for implementing such cooperation agreements in economic, trade, and tourism sectors.
Amir Abdullahian also discussed with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad recent developments, including the results of his talks with Lebanese and Russian officials related to the Syrian crisis. Maqdad expressed Syria's full support to Iran in its nuclear file.
Syria fully supports Iran in its efforts in the nuclear issue.
We strongly condemn the U.S. moves aimed at manipulating Iran's nuclear program and other regional affairs.
This is the second visit for the top Iranian official to Syria in less than 2 months. His trip is part of an international and regional tour which started in Russia.
Abdullahian's visit sends a clear message to the enemies of the resistance alliance that decades-long ties between the two countries are constantly developing, despite Western and Israeli pressures on both states. It's clear that the two countries maintain the same stance that resistance is the only path to victory in the face of their mutual enemies. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
An official France-Africa summit was organized by French President Macron in the southern French city Montpellier. He had invited state-linked members of the civil society and entrepreneurs. But even there, official participants criticized the colonial and paternalistic attitude of France in Africa. Later at the protest march and the counter-summit, held at the same time and in the same city, African analysts and human rights watchdogs said that France continues to exploit African countries, transferring uranium and other natural resources to Europe.
The position of France concerning authoritarian and dictatorial regimes has not changed. This was obvious when Macron went to Chad to support the son of former dictator Déby. France is maintaining its policy of political and military interference to defend its economic interests. France has not changed in this respect.
Political analyst Aziz Fall from Burkina Faso said that France is losing ground in Africa and is therefore using new tactics to seduce the civil society.
Well, basically, the French power is losing its grip in the region, and this is a major change compared to the so-called Cold War era. We have seen Russian, we have seen Chinese coming to the fierce competition, and we are witnessing a new scramble. The Americans are here, so the French need to review the way they will access to wealth in the country, and this is supposed to get rid of the support they have offered to these sellout leaders that are still leading our country.
Migrants formed a dynamic part of the protest march, demanding the end of evictions and official documents for everybody. Thousands died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. Those who succeeded this dangerous adventure became undocumented workers in Europe and faced the risk to be sent back every day.
Yesterday, Macron spoke to the African and French youth about culture, sports, and entrepreneurship. My question to him would have been, how can we be partner with France or Europe, given their policy which cost the life of 2,000 young Africans in the Mediterranean Sea only during the last 8 months?
President Macron says he wants to change the relations between France and African countries, but the pretty words at the official summit do not hide the facts on the ground. Undocumented workers have been arrested upon arriving here in Montpellier and received orders to leave the territory. Macron, with his anti-migrant policy, continues fishing in the waters of the racist far right, and that's a dangerous game. Christian Hunt, Montpellier.
Campaigners outside the Liverpool City Council, opposing an upcoming arms fair in their city, home to people of Yemeni and Palestinian heritage.
We are a safe haven and we are a safe place for refugees and people fleeing war. So why are we, on the one hand, being a refuge and on the other hand, selling the weapons that are causing the destruction to life and land and liberty?
The arms fair is set to kick off here in a few days, showcasing plane and missile components, drones and other military hardware. The building is owned by the city council that campaigners say has refused to cancel the fair despite months of protests and petitions.
I think we have a very right-wing council. They have a mask, they wear a mask, and they try to face both ways. They call themselves socialists, but they implement cuts to vulnerable people. They don't oppose the Tory cuts at all, and more shockingly than anything, they have said they are powerless to stop the arms fair.
Starting on October 12, the fair will provide a venue for some of the world's most notorious weapons makers, the UK's BAE Systems, which has made a bomb selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates to be used against Yemenis. Elbit Systems, a UK-based Israeli company accused of testing its deadly armaments on Palestinians. And American firm Raytheon, also a major supplier to Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
For the last 20 years, Britain has participated in a series of absolutely catastrophic wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, that have caused murder and mayhem around a huge arc of the world. And we really need that to change. And unfortunately, at the moment, our leaders are refusing to learn any lessons from those disasters.
Today's protest follows days of similar action against one of the world's largest arms fairs held in London just last month. And they're all calling for an end to arms exhibits in the UK and the government's unquestioning support for arms exports. Saeed Pourreza, Liverpool.
The limelight.